So the first time I traveled to Africa, we were in rural Kenya. And towards the end of the trip, they thought it would be a good idea if we were billeted in the home of one of the Kenyans we were visiting. And so we traveled to way out in the middle of nowhere. And I'm seeing Scott here. Did we stay in the same place? Okay, all right, wonderful. Hopefully I'm remembering this correctly then. But we traveled out to this, it was half hut, half brick building that had some electricity in it, actually. And we stayed with a family. And when we got there, it was clear that there was a bit of a language barrier. They spoke English a little bit, but not great. And so making conversation was a little bit tough. And they spent a long time making us just this beautiful, beautiful dinner. And it was lovely. We had dinner. And then as the evening came, we realized quite quickly that there wasn't a whole lot to talk about. And at one point, the host suggested that we watch a movie together. And we were all excited about that. Okay, good, because then we don't have to really chat so much. And so they had an old TV and a VCR. And the film they played for us was James Ucey's 1980 film, The Gods Must Be Crazy. You seen this film? In the film, if you haven't seen it, Z, he's a bushman living in a peaceful life in the Kalahari Desert. He stumbles upon a Coca-Cola bottle dropped in the sand. And the bottle is litter from an airplane passing overhead, but Z has never seen a glass bottle, let alone an airplane. In fact, he's never seen any kind of modern artifact, and so he believes the glass bottle to be a gift from the gods, and he takes it home to his tribe, and his tribe wonders over the object because they've never seen such a strange thing that was clear and yet so firm. And so they called it the strangest and most beautiful thing they had ever seen. But the allure of this mysterious object, it soon leads to jealousy, and they begin to fight over it, and they're hitting each other over the head with it, and the fighting breaks out, and Z is confused. Why would the gods send something to his people that would make them so unhappy? This object becomes deemed evil, and Z decides to travel and journey to the end of the world so he can throw it back to the gods. This mysterious glass bottle, it is believed, it does not belong to the earth. It was such an odd movie to be watching with a rural Kenyan family. I didn't really know what to do. I didn't, because they actually weren't that many steps removed from a tribe like Z's. And so I didn't know if I should laugh, if that would feel racist. I didn't know really what to do. It was a confusing movie to watch with them. But we watched it together. And what fascinated me about the film was how this standard object to us, a Coca-Cola bottle, is humorously shown in the film to be this source of mystery and wonder. And it showcases for us this very real sense that for someone who had never seen a Coke bottle before, its origin, its purpose would be a complete mystery. And it speaks to my own growing interest that's developing in me around anthropology and archaeology. I find these fields of study to be so fascinating, such a great dialogue partner for theology and faith. In fact, though it's something I find hard to explain, my experience last summer of finding and holding ancient Anasazi potsherds in the wilderness was one of the most profound, I think, experiences I've had over the last number of years. It was just this profound sense that I had discovered something in the ground that hadn't been touched by another human being for 1,000 years, and this weird sense of connection with this ancient culture. And I've been amazed in my study of the Anasazi how their artifacts that they left behind, the buildings, the rock art, the pottery, just how much these artifacts speak to their culture. It speaks to who they were and what they valued and what they believed. And so to pull an ancient artifact out of the ground from the soil to hold it, it was powerful for me in a way I can't quite explain, but it reinforced to me this idea that cultural artifacts or a culture's things communicate very distinct values and customs and ideas and beliefs. And it brings me to us and a teaching series that I'm working on for the fall that I would actually like to collaborate on with some of you. It might be a bad idea. I don't know. We'll see. That's not normally how it works. But I'm excited by this idea of possibly collaborating together. I've had this idea for 2 seasons now, but I'd love to see it come to fruition this next season in the fall. And the idea is simply this. What if, as a part of our next season, we created a series together about objects, things? What if some of us endeavored together to create an Archaeology of the Ordinary series, a series where we examine our own cultural artifacts and things in search of what they might say about us, and whether they might have a lesson to teach us about faith and spirituality? You might be thinking, well, why? Well, part of the point of the series, I think, in my mind, is to help us so that we might never look at our ordinary objects and things the same way again. Perhaps a series like this could help us see, in the words of Harriet Chessman, the exquisite worlds within ordinary things. And so perhaps, together, we could help each other see things with fresh eyes, open our eyes to the shimmering spirituality of the little objects that litter our homes and garages and cities. Might our objects have something to say to us, something to teach us about faith? This is the idea I want to create. And so, in the fall, I want to have what I'm calling an Archaeology of the Ordinary Guild. And for those interested, I hope you'll talk to me or email me after this morning. What I'm hoping to form is a group. We'd collaborate together and say, well, what would that look like? Well, for some of you, it might mean you preaching a whole sermon on an object, a thing. For others, it might be a story about a thing. For others, it might be helping with research. But I thought it would be perhaps of interest to some of you to invite you into this potential series for the fall. So, if you're interested, let me know. What I want to do is I want to meet in June to get it going, meet in August, and then we'll run with it from there. But you're probably thinking to yourself, what would that look like? Well, what I'd like to do this morning is model for you what I think a sermon on a thing could look like. And then you can get an idea of your head of where we could possibly go together. So, what might an object be that has something to say to us? Well, let's consider this morning the golf ball. One we probably pay little attention to, an object we've probably never really considered beyond something we see around or play with. But what does the golf ball mean? Consider these two quotes. Harry Brown says this: all of those lost golf balls in Loch Ness, in the Florida swamps, and in the churning sea off the cliffs of Cork remain an indelible object lesson from the moment in historical and geologic time when the human species liked to play games with nature. For Brown, he sees the golf ball as a symbol of humans' desire to conquest over nature, to compete with nature. Or consider T.S. Eliot. For him, the golf ball was a capsule, like a timepiece of modernity. And he said this of what a future generation might say about us: they were a decent and godless people whose only monuments were the asphalt road and 1,000 lost golf balls. For Eliot, the golf ball is a symbol of how we aren't a particularly deep people. Our monuments are the car and entertaining ourselves out in the woods, a culture of waste, perhaps. And so you start to get these ideas that some people have thought about the golf ball. For some people, it's a monument of our time. It's a monument of the petty things we do. For others, it's an object that signals our desire to overcome nature. But for me, the golf ball's meaning and lesson is far less grand than any of those. The golf ball in my mind is simply an object of frustration. I remember the very first time I discovered a golf ball. My brothers and I, we liked to play in our backyard, and we would hit around tennis balls and whatnot, and toying around in the shed, we discovered my dad's basket of golf balls, and we realized that if you hit a golf ball with a baseball bat, it will take off. And so in our backyard, directly behind the fence, were two houses. There was a narrow gap in between, a road, and then an empty lawn. And we would just go to town on those, ting, all across the road. We'd hit them all, then run around to the other street, grab the golf balls, bring them back again, because there was something magnetic about that sound of metal hitting a golf ball. And it's an absolute miracle we didn't break a window or hit another human being. It was a reckless, potentially very dangerous pastime we had in our backyard, but I couldn't shake that sound, ting, in the sight of the little white orb flying through the sky. It was a certain magic to it, a certain beauty about it. In fact, in all of sports, it's the object we can project the farthest It's an amazing thing, really. And so there was a fascination early on for me with golf. But I realized growing up that as I matured and played the game a little bit, that this wasn't exactly my thing. And this was driven home to me in the most pointed way the time I was invited out by a politician. He invited me to play golf with him. And I had done my work. I had worked at the driving range. I had put in some time. And he courted me and wanted me to come out and play with him at a golf course. And he said he was interested in maybe helping support Nexus get off the ground. And so I was like, oh, okay, here we go. And I didn't realize, though, that we were headed to Whistle Bear. I realized quite quickly that I was out of my league. You realize very quickly at Whistle Bear, for those of us who are in no way high class, that's a place that will reinforce that idea to you very quickly. You pulled up there, and there's like butler people who take your golf bags out, and they wash down your clubs, and they set things up for you. And the golf balls have GPS in them, so you can track on a little screen where your golf ball is. And so we were chatting, and I just was so embarrassed the whole time, and it was clear he was embarrassed I was out there because my balls were everywhere, left, right, all over the place. And so we'd be hollering at each other, hey, when do you want to talk about Nexus? As soon as I get out of the woods here, well, it was just mortifying. Dave Mara, a PGA veteran, he once said this about golf: you can never own the secret of golf. You just try to borrow it from time to time, which sounds clever to me, except at this point in my life, I was convinced only certain people were capable of borrowing the secret. And I wasn't one of them. And so no matter what I seemed to do, I just couldn't figure out how to make that pesky little ball go straight. And I tried everything. The experts, the big names, of course, Bobby Jones in his book, Golf is My Game, he argues that golf is an exercise in control. He says that any golfer must become a well-tuned instrument. To become a really fine golfer, he writes, a person must have the knowledge of the basic requirements of the proper golf swing, work hard to drill his muscles in the performance of this exacting ritual. And so he continues on by saying, the most important thing in golf is hitting the ball. Which, really, hitting the ball. So done. I'm like, okay, I'm out of the driving range. Just concentrate on hitting the ball. But then you have someone like Ben Hogan, his book Five Lessons. He writes, no. He writes this in capital letters. The most important thing is a correct, powerful, repeating swing. And so I'd be out there practicing. Got to repeat the swing. Got to make sure I hit the ball. Practice. And of course, everybody's an expert too. They're giving you hints out on the course. I was always hearing from people. Golf, Jack Nicklaus in his book Golf My Way, he says, the most important thing is keeping your head down. And so I had all this knowledge in my head, trying to keep my head down, repeat my swing over and over. And yet my golf game maybe got a little bit better, but not in any way that was noticeable. And none of these things seemed to help me in the short term. What these masters of golf seemed to convey was, golf is a game where you must discipline yourself, systematically apply a few fundamental principles. And yet I found it so incredibly tough. Technique matters, practice matters. The great experts say, yes, you can practice technique, but it can only be learned really through the exasperating experience of actually playing the game over and over. And so that's what I tried to do, play the game until the day I would retire from golf, what I'm calling the hole from hell. Because these things seem to only happen to people like me. I took a drive and it looked beautiful for about 2 seconds, and then veered off into the woods, and my brothers were the ones golfing with me, and so they drove over in our little carts, and there I was behind some trees. I needed to get it out on the green, and I knew I just need to get it to the right, keep it low. I took a swing, and then I heard that sound. Very, very interesting sound. Almost as nice as a golf ball on metal as a golf ball on wood. And it hit the tree in front of me, bounced off a tree behind me, and smacked me in the head. Oh, and it hurt. Like, that hurts. Jeez. And my brothers are laughing. Oh, goodness. Finally managed to get it out, and I landed in the sand trap. I took one swing and it went up and rolled back. A second up and rolled back again. This time I'm like, I'm going to lose it. And then I and buried it in the sand. It took me 6 swings to get out of the sand trap. And then on my next tee, on my next putt, it rolled over and went into the opposing sand trap. I was livid. I was livid. I hate this game. Why, I'm thinking to myself, am I investing time and money in a game that just drives me insane? So I retired after an illustrious 3-year career. Because mastering this little ball, controlling this little ball, to me seemed unattainable. And it was in that this little golf ball began to speak to me. This little object has become a profound object lesson for me. Is this, when things feel unattainable, when we have been embarrassed countless times in the trying, when our efforts have proved in vain, the easiest course of action is to simply give it up. Stop trying at all. Which is why, in the Nexus Weekly, I asked you to read through the entire Sermon on the Mount before Sunday, Matthew's 5-7. Because in many ways, these 3 chapters, to me, they hold the key for what it means to live as a Christian. They're sort of our things that we do and strive to be. They hold the teachings we strive to live by. They're the heart of the Christian faith and how we live and act. And yet, as I read through these 3 chapters, reflect on the teachings there, as I reflect on my history with them, I can't help but ask myself the same question I ask about golf. Is this even attainable? I mean, if you went through this weekend, the demands of these teachings are so lofty, it seems practically impossible to obey. Consider some of the highlights, if you will. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the peacemakers. And I think, God, why? Way prefer to be on a side. Feel more comfortable there. Anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. No anger? Really? That's the only way I feel catharsis in life. You've heard it said, you shall not commit adultery, but I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. I think, God, why'd you make people so beautiful then? I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. I think, God, but I don't want to take crap from anyone because that's not good for my self-esteem. I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. But God, you don't understand. My enemies are morons. When you give to the needy, do not announce it. What? The best part of being generous is subtly hinting to other people at how generous you are. If you forgive other people when they sin against you, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. It's like, come on, really? Do not worry about tomorrow. For tomorrow will worry about itself. Worrying is the one thing I excel at. Jeez, God, do you know how stressful life is? Do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. It's not fair. My standards for other people is exceptionally higher than my own standards for myself. This feels an impossible task. No anger. No lust. No retaliation, loving enemies, no worry or anxiety. Most people, if you read through the sermon straight, it's just an exercise in being overwhelmed. Most of us just don't think we can obey these commands. In fact, Martin Luther made popular the notion that the sermon was actually given to us to be unattainable. He made the argument that the sermon is actually intended to humble us, to show us how salvation by works is not possible. And so for him, the idea behind the sermon was to make it practically impossible for us to live by in order to humiliate us, expose any attempts we might have at sort of a works-based righteousness. And so for Luther, the sermon was, well, it's unattainable. It's there to show you cannot attain perfection. That's the point. But I don't buy it. I don't buy it. Because when I look at various parts of the sermon, even the hardest parts, like turning the other cheek, loving enemies, I'm pretty certain that people in history have attained these standards. Christian history is full of the biographies of saints who have loved enemies and turned the other cheek. And so it's a bit like the same watching golf. Out on the course, golf to me feels unattainable, but I watch golf highlights. I can't watch a game, that's too boring, but I watch the highlights and people do it. People do it. Shooting under par on a tough course seems humanly unattainable to me, but others attain it. It is within human capability to achieve that. In fact, though it's only happened to me once in my whole career, there was a time when I shot one under par. It was beautiful. I had a drive, and for some mysterious reason, it didn't slice like it always does. And I landed in the unfamiliar spot of being on the fairway. I've never been there before. It's beautiful there. Trees around, gorgeous. Like, okay, you can do this, Brad. I know you've never been here. You can do this. And so I concentrated, and my next shot also stayed straight and landed right on the green. At this point, I'm shaking in my boots. I can hardly believe my luck here. And then I did it. A putt in, one under par. I couldn't believe it. I threw my club. I did a cartwheel. It was like that moment of pure joy. In fact, Harry Brown says this, every golfer, even the most feckless duffer, I like that line, at least occasionally has felt the ecstasy of a perfect strike. Hitting the sweet spot is a universal experience that connects all golfers through an ephemeral but ineffable joy. Love that. I've only experienced it once, but I can relate. I think this to me is where this pesky little ball and the Sermon on the Mount come together for me. I think the reality for the two of them is this. On any given shot, a great swing and hit is possible. And I think it's the same with the Sermon on the Mount. In any given moment, on any given day, I think the Sermon on the Mount is attainable. In any given moment, it's possible to love an enemy, to turn the other cheek. It's possible. Every time we step up the swing, it's possible. Is it sustainable? No. I don't think it's possible to sustain decade after decade a faultless adherence to the Sermon on the Mount. In fact, I think that's why we're taught to pray in the Sermon on the Mount, forgive us our sins. And so no, in any given moment, I don't think the sermon is sustainable over the long term, but on any given shot, any given attempt, any given day, it's attainable. We really should try to attain the ideal set out in the Sermon on the Mount. On the flip side, it's so overwhelming, we know we're going to fail, and often. Living by the Sermon on the Mount will spell a life of chronic failure, and maybe that's the point. Maybe the point is consistently trying, and in that, learning to find joy in frustration. Joy in frustration. Golf is hard. It's a frustrating and infuriating game. Hence Mark Twain's famous quote, right? Golf is a good walk spoiled. If you've ever played golf, you know that. But unless we can recalibrate and learn to find the joy in frustration, learn to find joy in the learning process, slow and full of failure though it will be. The challenge, of course, is that anything as difficult as the Sermon on the Mount, it can cause people to come undone, come unglued. Not only have I done these things, but I've seen golfers curse, throw clubs, break clubs, some like me, out of frustration, retire. I think the same thing happens often with the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount is so hard, we become demoralized. Wallowing in guilt can often lead to us, I think, just giving up altogether. Stop even going there. It becomes basically like that dusty golf bag sitting in your garage that you never take out and play with. We leave the Sermon on the Mount and scriptures, and we read it, we think, I'm not ready to go there. But it doesn't have to be that way. Yes, the sermon is difficult. Failure is inevitable. We have to recalibrate ourselves so we can find joy in frustration. And what does that look like, you say? What does it mean to find joy in frustration? You know, I'm not entirely sure, but again, this little ball, I think, can help. I think it starts with a mindset shift. Last summer, my brothers implored me, please come out of retirement. Please come join us on the golf course. That's a bad idea.
Like, he could be like Michael Jordan, come out of retirement.
Yeah.
So I said, I really don't want to. I don't like myself on the golf course. I don't like who I become. I said, come on, it'll be fun. And so I prepped myself. I had like a prepping moment, and I came to the conclusion, all right, I'll do it on, I'm going to come, but I'm not keeping score. I'm not going to keep score. Actually, I think it was Warren that taught me this method. Right. Go, but don't keep score. So I went, and I lost 18 balls. One on... Yeah, I don't think you understand how bad I am. A lot of times people will say, no, come on, come and golf. I say, I'm bad. And they're like, oh, I'm sure you're okay. I'm like, I've never shot under 130 in my life. Never once. I'm bad. So I lost 18 golf balls that day, but I wasn't keeping score. And I had a beer in my hand, and my brother's company around me. The sun was shining. I was just able to enjoy myself. Frustrated? Yes. But I found I could enjoy myself. I easily cut my curse word ratio in half that day. It was just right in half. And so I found, at least in that one moment, joy, a certain joy in frustration. Didn't lose my cool. Instead of it being a good walk spoiled, it was a good walk with many detours. And for me, that's the attitude I'm trying to find as I approach the Sermon on the Mount these days. It's the attitude I'm trying to approach the Christian faith, the Christian walk with. I'm trying to incorporate more intentional forms of prayer in my life, like I talked about last week, contemplative prayer, sitting with Jesus, trying to set intentions, trying to simply be present to areas that I'm not great in. And I know I'll fail. I'm okay with that. I think God's okay with that too. Because what I'm learning, or at least trying to learn, is that I think the key to becoming a skilled Christian is to practice the faith with joy, even in failure. Because I've seen the alternative in my life and the life of others. The alternative is guilt, shame, anger. It leads to us giving up on the game. Our journey of faith becomes a good walk spoiled. But I swear it can be a good walk without the spoiled part. There'll be detours, times where we're lost in the woods, far from where we should be. But if we can learn to find the joy and frustration, even in failure, with the right company around us, I'm convinced it's possible. On any given shot, any given moment, any given day, we set up our tee. Take a shot at the Beatitudes, at loving enemies, at leaving fear behind, worry behind, at turning the other cheek. We can succeed. At times, we're going to hear that sweet sound of metal on a golf ball, the sweet sound of a perfect shot, because on any given hole, it's possible. Other times, we're going to hear the awful sound of landing in the woods. Our attempts slice hard to the right, and so we're going to fail a lot. But again, what I'm learning as I get older, or I should say, trying to learn, is what's important is how we handle failure, how we handle a poor shot, a poor hole. I think that ultimately determines whether or not you keep coming back at it. If you can handle failure with a sense of grace, a mark of joy, perhaps a sense of humor, chances are you'll keep coming back and trying again. And in that, you'll get more skilled over time. So let's keep hitting, striving, coming back to the tee. I'm going to ask the band to come and close. Perhaps we could do that hip song again, because I love that line, no dress rehearsal, right? Like, this is beautiful, beautiful song. But this is what I'm thinking of. I'm interested in collaborating together on this series, The Fall, that looks maybe something a little bit like what I just did. An object, take a thing, examine it for its implicit lessons, help us to look at it so that it no longer is an ordinary object to us. And so if you're interested in being part of the Archaeology of the Ordinary Guild, email me this week. For some, again, it might mean preaching a whole sermon. Others, it could be telling a story. Others, it could be helping with simply research. But again, my hope, desire for at least some of The Fall, the next season, is to help us see objects, things with radically new and fresh eyes. Try to find the lesson in that. So, in the meantime, let's step up to the tea. Yes. Careful now. And so, you think I set up a cheat? And so, blessed are the merciful. And the slices to the right. Ben, take us away.